it is generally a very good idea to spend time considering the worst case scenario and whether you can emotionally take that. Financially, can you take it? And the older you get in life, the more severe those consequences are.
How are you? Welcome to the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast with me, Gary Fox. Today, my guest is Oisin Hanrahan, and it is a pleasure to welcome him back to the podcast. He was on previously when he was the CEO of Angie, which at the time was a $7 billion company. Yeah, billion would it be? But he's a born entrepreneur and he's back with his latest venture. It's called Keychain, and this might be the biggest revolution in manufacturing and retailing in this century. It is that big an idea. Just a reminder, this is your final call for my course with Shane Craddock. It's called Mindshift, the Entrepreneur Experiment Edition. We run it every year and we're in the final couple of weeks for you to register. Spots are limited, so we mightn't be able to fit everyone in and we won't run it until next year. Best investment you always make is in yourself. I'd strongly recommend you invest in yourself and invest in this course with Shane and myself. You'll find the details in the description or search Mindshift, the Entrepreneur Experiment Edition. Now, on with today's chat with Oisin. Over the past 5 years in this podcast, I've spoken to loads of amazing Irish businesses who grew from one idea to become world-class companies, able to compete with the best on the international stage. And many of those started up and grew with the help of their local enterprise office. From starting or growing to become more sustainable or digitization, the local enterprise offices have everything to help make it happen for your business. Visit localenterprise.ie or click the link in the bio below. Okay, you know me. You know I'm massively into my health, fitness, and training. But there's one thing I haven't spoken about before, and that is a product I take every single day. It's a product called Resilience, and it's made by an Irish company called Ethos. What's kind of funny is that every single entrepreneur I meet, that is the one characteristic they have, incredible resilience. So I like that little play on words. It's a multifunctional supplement that supports cognitive function, immunity, which is super important this time of year, energy levels, and it keeps stress at bay. I also love it because it's easy. If you're bringing anything new habit into your life, it has to be easy, and taking Resilience is so simple. I simply mix it in a glass of water every single morning, and I always throw a couple of extra in my gym bag to keep them with me. It's a really tasty blood orange flavor as well. It ticks all the boxes. It has B vitamins, amino acids, vitamin C, and adaptogens like reishi mushroom and ashwagandha. So, if you want to try it, I think you should. Go to weareethos.com. And because I like it so much, the guys have given me a discount code. So if you go to weareethos.com, enter Gary Fox at the checkout, you'll get 20% off, which makes taking Resilience about €1 a day, which is an unbelievable price for building some inner resilience. Check out weareethos.com. If you've been listening for a while, you'll know Iconic Offices have been my partner and home in the pod for a long time now. Working and recording their spaces has helped support the ambitious goals of the pod and, to be honest, really helped it grow. So I partner with them to give you, my fellow entrepreneurs, the opportunity to work from Iconic Offices spaces and experience it for yourself. No fees, no catches. Simply visit the Iconic Offices link in the show notes below, enter the code GARY24 and claim your free co-working day pass, or bring the whole team with you and book a day office. I only get to say this a couple of times. Oisin, welcome back to the pod.
Great to be back. What a wonderful day to be talking to you.
And it's a bit of a landmark day. What is it?
Today is day one in Keychain's new office. And by day one, I mean very early in the day. We're like 2 hours in. So if the internet goes out, or if we're told we're in the wrong room, probably because we're in the wrong room. So we're excited to figure it all out. Most important thing I did today was bring my granola to work. So I want to make sure that I had a snack, because
got to fuel the brain cells. And you showed me your view there a minute ago. It's remarkable. So you're looking out at what part of New York are you looking out at?
We are down in the financial district, so we're looking out over the Hudson River. We're looking out over where World Trade used to be, and we can see the new World Trade Building out the window as well. So yeah, we're looking out over the Lower Manhattan skyline.
The New York skyline is special. Every time you see it, it's really just off from the movies. What is New York back? Like, New York was written off during COVID. Is it back?
New York is definitely back. It's different, but it's back.
How so?
I think during COVID, it really got hit. It really got hit extremely hard during COVID. A lot of people left, myself included. It was just a very tough place to endure the lockdowns and the restrictions and all the madness that we all went through during COVID. And I think the journey to being back has pushed and prodded and, you know, shifted New York around a little bit. Like, you know, you think about the journey to come back. It started with like, okay, come in a couple of days a week, and people were, you know, starting to come in on Tuesday, Wednesdays, or Tuesdays and Thursdays. And I think what that meant was the city became incredibly busy on those days, but still emptied out on a Monday and a Friday. Mm. And then, you know, as schools pick back up, like my, you know, I have two small kids, and they're, one of them's in like a daycare and the other's in like a school program. Like, for anyone whose kids are in school, like, you get back into a 5 day a week routine pretty quickly. So, you know, the neighborhoods that were school based, or that had a lot of school going kids, they developed more of the normalcy of, okay, well, kids are going to be dropped off at school 5 days a week. The coffee shops and the, you know, restaurants that kind of worked around that schedule or lived around that schedule, revived pretty quickly. And then more recently, as companies have pushed for 4 to 5 day a week back in the office, you know, you've started to see real resurgence and real demand for a more normal, what we would have called normal existence. And, you know, it doesn't mean that all of the office space and all the rental space is recovered, but, you know, there are certain parts of it that are still hurting for sure. So lower grade office space is still incredibly available. There's still a serious oversupply of that. But, you know, for high grade office space, there's, you know, more demand than supply, as people are saying, look, if I'm going to have, you know, fewer people in the office, because my workforce has become distributed, those people in the office are, you know, we're going to invest in great space. So, you know, I think net, it's different than it was, but it's definitely back. Like New York is a extremely, it's just an incredibly resilient place. Like, it just has so much inbound demand. And you contrast, and it's such diversity of, you know, economic base. Like, you contrast that to San Francisco, which is still, you know, it's obviously gotten some tailwind because of the resurgence in AI investment. But San Francisco, you know, you walk the city and it's still got a lot of challenges in terms of, you know, homelessness and vacant buildings. But I think New York has risen quite. It felt like it was slow, you know, to come out of it. But I guess on a relative basis, it's recovered quite quickly.
That's really interesting. But the school's been a contributing factor in Dublin. It still feels the same. We still kind of, I think we're somewhere between New York and San Francisco. Demand for high level offices is high, but like the amount of vacant office space is insane. Like for the lower grade, like you said, they're like, and it's exactly that reason. If you're asking people to come into the office, they're expecting 5-star facilities. Where do you think it goes?
It's just like the workforce has shifted. I think we kind of moved toward a bit of this at Handy and Angie, but we've really embraced it with the new company, which is to ask ourselves the question: for hiring talent, where's the best place to put that talent? And if the talent doesn't need to be in the core at the center of operations, like we're not doing that. Like, you know, I think about, you know, the early Handy team versus the early Keychain team that we've got. You know, the early Handy team was all in New York, all in one place, you know, until we got to 40, 50 people. And, you know, I think about where we're building Keychain and, you know, we effectively have two hubs. We have a, you know, small hub here in New York, but we have a substantial footprint already in India, in Delhi. And I think about that as like, you know, I don't know, maybe we would have been brave enough to do that anyway, post the Angie experience where we, learned how to run these offshore centers better. But I do think that the COVID experience of running extremely dispersed remote operations changed a lot of companies and pushed them to ask the question, do we need to hire this person in the center of our operations? Or can we say, actually, we're going to have a core team in Dublin or Cork or Galway, but we're okay with, X percent of our team being remote because it gives us access to different talent. It gives us access to a different cost base some other, inherent advantage in people operations. So, yeah, I think that's a real shift for, why certain office space is in demand and certain office spaces is not.
Do you think that is the future of modern companies like you? I mean, you're starting from a blank slate canvas, so you can kind of design it exactly how you want. Was that your intentional thinking to have a core and then outsource other elements?
I don't know if it's the future. I mean, again, two things changed, obviously, at the same time for me. One is I had the experience of Angie and Handy, and I went at this next company with that lens of, okay, what worked? What did I learn? And then the second thing is the whole world shifted in terms of its approach to remote work and Zoom and all that stuff. So it's hard to say whether, it's hard to say whether there'll be a general shift to that, but it feels logical, right? It feels logical. It certainly feels rational and normal to ask yourself the question, all right, what's essential for us to put in our core? And typically the core is a higher cost location. Like, think about us here today. Like, we've moved, 10 folks into this new office. And it was a relatively easy, seamless move. Whereas if we were moving the 40, 50 folks we have in Delhi around, it would have been a much more thoughtful, deliberate, and costly, frankly, decision to do that. So I think it just gives you greater flexibility. It gives you more leverage, and allows you, I think, to move. I think it allows you to move a little faster if you can build the team and build your operations in the right way.
Nice. So for anyone not familiar with Oisin's story, you can go back to listen to episode 136 of the pod, where we talked about his construction of Handy, how it was sold then to Angie. So when we spoke last, you'd kind of risen up to become CEO of Angie. Like, what was that process like during COVID? Because I know it was an extremely difficult time. The company was, it was quite labor intensive. Like, you were partnering customers with handymen and people like that. So how did that process go? Just give a quick recap on that.
Yeah. For sure. I noticed you said 136. How many episodes of this podcast?
We're on three. This one will probably be 330, maybe.
Well, that's quite an amazing accomplishment.
Thank you.
So, sorry, back to the question of, like, how was it running Angie and doing that during COVID? Though COVID was a wild time. COVID was, I recall the beginning of COVID. And at the time, I had a one-year-old. So my daughter was, I think she might have been less than one at the beginning of COVID. She would have been like 11 months old. So I'm going through the madness of having an 11-month-old first-time parent. But my wife and I are confused ever. We're at that point, we're confused every single day by, what was going on, and were we going to manage to keep our child alive? Not because we were, bad parents, but just because we were simply confused every single day about what every cough and every splutter
meant. It's so wild. It's wild. Wreck.
Yeah, exactly. You're going through it right now.
Yeah, she's one. So like every cough, every time she comes home from crash, you're like yesterday they rang up and they're like, she's got a little rash. Nothing to worry about. And you're like, well, I'm glad there's one adult who can tell me what's going on, because I don't know.
I look at the day. So we use this pediatrician here that has this like online portal thing that you log into to make appointments, and it shows you your record, like whenever you log in. Here's all your appointments and here's everything you've done. And like for Livy, our first child, it's like, you went to the doctor 40 something times in her life, and like just about five. And then it's Orion, our second. It's like, in his 3 years, you've gone twice. And you're like,
okay,
he was that much healthier, or just because we were, you know, irrational parents.
What's the data telling me here?
Is it more likely that he's that different as a child, or that we just like were on a really slow learning curve with Livy that we just couldn't get it together? But anyway, I guess all that's relevant only in the sense of like the beginning of COVID. There was just this insane pandemonium and panic. We'd recently sold, I guess, Handy to Angie's List. That would have been, I guess, 2018. So 2020 would have been a couple of years later. And we're going through the process of like thinking about expanding and like we were expanding aggressively actually at that point inside Angie. And COVID hit. And I would say for the first 2 weeks of COVID, all we could think about was, is this business going to survive? Like, are we going to be bankrupt? To the point where, like, I remember being on these daily calls, sometimes it was twice a day, we were doing like leadership calls. And, you know, we were considering everything from, do we need to fire people? Do we need to, you know, reduce people? Do we need to do, I can't even remember the term, but basically like some sort of furlough. And then there was like all sorts of cons, like obviously the offices were closing and like, what do we do? And how do people work from home? And do we get them to work? And fast forward about 3 or 4 weeks past that, and we were not just in like a different world. We were in a world that you couldn't have imagined at that point, which was we were tiger by the tail. All anyone wanted to do was buy home services because they were stuck in their house. And all we were trying to do was figure out how we could possibly provide people with enough home services to meet the demand. Like the flip in that biz, it was just like such a head fake. It was like, hey, we're going this way and it looks really bad, really bad. And then at the last possible moment, it's like, actually, home services are going to be an essential service. Everyone is going to want to buy them. And all you're going to have to do is like, just try hang on for dear might while you try and ride the crazy roller coaster. And that pretty much that theme of just trying to hang on, was the theme of COVID. Like it was for the Angie business. It was literally every person had the exact same thought at the same time. Like everyone was like, let's buy sourdough, or let's learn how to make sourdough bread. And then it was like, let's put a fire pit in our backyard. And every partner we had, so, you know, Walmart and Costco and Target and Lowe's would sell out of fire pits instantly. And, you know, we'd go from installing like a couple of hundred fire pits a week to like thousands of them in a day.
It's wild. Like it was in, like you said, when you explain it there going, yeah, the whole world is going to shut down, but then everyone's going to really want to do up their house. You know, people can't go out anymore, so they're going to want to buy like barbecues and fire pits and install home bars and jacuzzis and saunas. Like, who has that on their bingo card at the start of the year going, do you know what's going to happen? This is why we're going to be a massive success. Like,
oh, and go further than that. And what we're going to do is we're going to print so much money,
yes,
that we're going to have to drop it out of helicopters and force it into people's bank accounts. Such that affordability will never be a question for the next 24 months.
Yeah.
Everyone will just have an irrational amount of money because we will put so many government subsidies in the system at every possible level that you will not have the problem of affordability. Instead, you'll have the problem of, you know, can you possibly get people to go to work because they're getting so much money in COVID subsidy payments? Like it was just, oh, and we'll keep interest rates so low and mm-hmm. we'll lend at such low margins, in fact, near zero, that it'll be cheaper to borrow than pay the credit. Like, here's an example. I remember there was one particular deal we were looking at during COVID where, you know, you as a business, whenever you accept a credit card, it costs you, you know, between 2-3% to accept the credit card payment. And there was this buy now, pay later business. I genuinely can't remember which one it was, but they probably wouldn't appreciate me telling the story about them anyway, if I could. But, and they had this deal, which was they would advance the money for 90 days and it would cost us less to lend the customer the money than it would to process the credit card and get paid immediately.
You know? Oh my God.
So they were absorbing all the credit risk and they were lending the money, like the time value of money. So the time value of money at that point was like zero. So there was no cost in the money, but they were absorbing all the credit risk and lending to the customer for 90 days. And it was going to cost us less than the couple of points we had to pay the credit card. So we were basically going to our customers and saying, I know you want to use your Amex, your Visa card to pay us, but instead, could you use this other service and we'll give you 1% back in order to do it. And it'll still cost us less. Like that was the degree to which that time was just that made no sense.
All business rationality went out the window. Even listening to you explain that to me, my head is kind of going, how did we all just kind of go with this? How do we all, like, instead of going down, the economy boomed, share prices went through the roof. Like, but this is, like, why I'm kind of laboring this point is that, you know, we're always kind of looking for trends and patterns and routines and things that we can look and go, yes, that's going to happen again. Like, often, and I was speaking to an entrepreneur this morning who'd gone through something similar. He had an Airbnb software business, which he just sold now, and he thought the same thing. He was like, oh, we're dead. Short-term rentals, dead, never coming back. 1 month was down, the next month was record growth and continued infinitely. Like,
yeah,
because everyone wanted to leave the cities. He goes, we just saw this complete inverse of like, no one wanted to go to the cities, everyone wanted to go to like South Carolina and Wexford, and everyone wanted to get out of the city and just take all these short-term rentals, and the whole market boomed. So like, and his whole thesis was, which I liked, is like, you just got to stay alive long enough to catch that wave. Whatever that wave will be, you just got to stay alive long enough because eventually a wave will come and you'll be there.
Stay alive long enough and it'll help if the government prints more money than they've ever printed in their history.
Is that what America is struggling with right now? Are we now coming to see the shakeout of that?
I think yes. I think we're unwinding what was a period of, you know, excessive monetary expansion, where we collectively expanded the economy less through, you know, raw productivity or innovation gains, or, you know, the volume of people operating in it, but instead through monetary means. And that eventually has a price. We've all seen the inflation that resulted from it. And I think we're still threading a needle on how softly we're going to land from that. You know, if you look at the data and you talk to people, I think we're doing better than we thought we would. You know, you rewind 6, 9, 12 months ago, an abrupt economic landing seemed more likely than less. I think now we seem to have moved inflation downward without crashing the economy. But I think we have some real sticky structural problems that may prove harder to get out, to undo than we're giving it credit for. Like, I think we've made some changes, particularly around our source of goods that will make it harder to truly tame inflation back to where it was. Like the China hedge has gone away, right? The fact that we had this long-term shift of production to a cheaper location, whether it's for geopolitical reasons or other reasons, we are not moving production to China anymore. Our imports from China are not, you know, expanding at the rate they were. They're contracting. That, you know, has an inflationary effect. Like if you reshore production away from China or even nearshore it, that pushes up the cost of goods. And that's we took the geopolitical genie out of the bottle, and it's hard to see us putting that back together, right? It's hard to see us saying, okay, we're going to push back toward imports from China at an aggressive rate, and I think that's hard. I think the second one is, you know, frankly, led by more of our European partners, is the shift toward toward more sustainable, environmentally friendly production. Whether, you know, we can call it the Green New Deal, or we can call it whatever we want to call it, whatever political term we want to put on it. But making things in an environmentally friendly way is simply costlier. It is like it just costs us more in the short term. Maybe, you know, maybe it is economically better long term when you factor in all the individual costs of all the other things. But it is simply more expensive in the short term to bundle in all of the environmental costs into making something, and that is going to cause us to have that's going to cause us to have, you know, higher costs of services, of goods and services. And again, it's not to say we shouldn't be doing that. You know, I think we should be embedding our total cost of ownership into things. But that's, you know, I think Europe is really embraced that in a much more wholesome way than America has. I think the last one is, we still haven't solved our approach to immigration in the U.S. So it's not to say it's ever going to be solved, but we have a more clunky, restricted immigration and frankly dysfunctional immigration situation than we've had in quite some time. And I think that makes it hard for us to have labor supply. And without labor supply, you know, at every level, it's hard to see us getting our cost of services under control, which is, again, so I think those three things. The last one is, you know, arguably more technically solvable, but harder to solve politically. But those three things are a pretty significant contrast to where we were, you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, when those were not, you know, massive price drivers for the average consumer.
And when you left Angie, you've gone again almost pretty quickly. Were factors like that at the front of your mind to go again? Because Keychain seems perfectly positioned to kind of like solve a lot of those problems, really. For anyone not familiar with Keychain, just give a quick overview of what it is, and then kind of give me an outline of why it all started.
Sure. So the thesis behind Keychain is, if you go to the grocery store today and you buy product, most of the product in the store is not made by the label on the box. So you think about, you know, whether you buy a private label at Tesco or Target or Walmart or Marks & Spencer, or whether you buy from any of the, you know, more recently health-focused brands, like, you know, the gluten-free brands, the paleo brands, the dairy-free, nut-free, etc. Brands that have emerged. Most of those products are actually made by manufacturers and packers that specialize in manufacturing, but don't necessarily have any consumer-facing brand. And that's different than it was, call it 20 odd years ago, where manufacturing was more consolidated and it was, you know, owned by the P&G, Procter & Gamble's, or the Unilever's, or the Mondelez, or the PepsiCo's of the world, did a lot more of the manufacturing, frankly, under their core brands than they do today. And what we identified was this big gap between how brands and retailers find manufacturers, and similarly how manufacturers find brands and retailers. Today that happens entirely at trade shows or through brokers, and it's a very clunky, messy, fractious process. And, you know, when we think about what we spent the last 12 years doing at Handy and at Angie, it was building a two-sided marketplace. So what we've decided to do at Keychain is take the world's manufacturers and build a marketplace that matches them, or build a platform that matches them with brands and retailers. So we're out there researching, particularly starting with CPG, so consumer packaged goods, or what we may call FMCG, fast moving consumer goods, and food and beverage to start with. And we're indexing the world's manufacturers and creating a platform to identify them for brands and retailers to find them, and also ultimately to actually buy and sell the line time, so the manufacturing capacity at those plants. And, you know, if we get this right, we think it'll have a pretty significant impact on the food on our shelves. So, you know, you go to the store today, and for decades, we've been telling people in order to be healthier, spend more time in the fruits and vegetables aisle, spend more time in the fresh foods aisle. And in reality, that makes up less than 20% of the grocery store. The other 80% is packaged goods. And we have a thesis that if we can just make the packaged goods part of the store healthier, it's a whole lot easier than telling people to change their behavior. And one of the ways we can make the packaged goods part of the store healthier is by making it easier for people to put great product on the shelf. So I fundamentally believe that people want to do the right thing. They want a great product on the shelf. But when it comes down to it, and somebody is a decision maker at, you know, a major brand or an emerging brand or in a private label or white label brand, and they're saying, look, I only have this one shot to put a product on the shelf. It's going to take me 6 months to get it out there. I'm going to cost me a fortune. And, you know, there's two choices. And one is to make a better for you, lower sugar product. And the other one is to make a worse for you, higher sugar, higher salt product. The person's under so much stress and pressure, it's such a long cycle that they don't take the risk to say, well, actually, maybe we can market this healthier product, because, you know, their career or the whatever is riding on the fact that, you know, they have this one shot to put a product on the shelf. So we think if we make it easier for people to put product on the shelf by making it less expensive, by making it lower risk, by shrinking the timelines, that people will actually put healthier product on the shelf. And I think we've seen that in certain categories. Like, we've seen the better for you trend kind of start to emerge in certain food groups. But I think there's a, you know, a need more than ever for us to think about how to put better for you product on the shelf, because, you know, the pharma guys have another alternative, which is all of us just take Ozempic, which seems like a bad outcome. Obviously, Ozempic is suitable for some folks, and, you know, has a clinical need. You know, but the rapid rise in Ozempic as a you know, general solution to weight management, as opposed to, you know, a shift toward better diet and a shift toward healthier food. Shelf.
You're tackling the outcome, not the cause. Like, I like that. I like that thinking. You've kind of gone up the layer of thinking in terms of, I think it's a Buffett quote, is that, show me your incentives, I'll show you your outcomes. Like, it's very true. Like, and we all like to, you know, people are inherently good. People want to make the right decision from a consumer point of view and also from a manufacturer point of view. You know, people don't want to put out shit products. But like you say, if Mark has to get this out by Q3 and it's this choice or this choice, this meets Q3, he's going to get it squeezed through, and then the trickle-down effect happens. So I like that. When I read it, I was like, oh, it's just one of those ideas. You kind of go, makes perfect sense, because I speak to so many brands all the time and they're like, oh, it's such a nightmare. We got samples, took 8 weeks, sent them back. Then they sent us the wrong color that we got to manufacture. It didn't match what we're... And like, they're literally go. And I was like, oh, how... And usually when I talk to them, they're like, I was like, how'd you find them? Google search. Alibaba. And you're like, it's wild. So when you said that, when I read your LinkedIn post, I was like, oh, that's just, it's just so logical. A big problem to solve, but very logical. Yep. Talk to me about your decision to get back in the game though, because I'm fascinated by your psychology of, you'd run a company, you built and sold your old company into a massive company. And why I asked you that original question about like, what was it like? Because I can count probably on one hand, probably couple of fingers, the amount of founders who've been bought out, stayed with the company and risen to run it is minimal to none. Usually it's like, get bought out, a couple of months of disillusionment, do my earn out, gone. That's like, everyone follows that path, whereas you took the opposite path.
Why did I do that? That sounds like so much.
That's what I want to find out. When you went in, right, I won't labor this too much, but when you left then, what was your immediate thought? What did you want to do, or did you want to do anything?
I mean, why did I stay? I mean, maybe it's like some sort of weird upbringing, like an Irish Catholic, like guilt, and like, I don't know, like
you've made your bed, now lie in it.
I desire for suffering and, you know, pain and whatever. So let me unpack the different parts of it. Look, when I sold it to Angie, it wasn't impossible. Like it was discussed at the time that I was going to take, would have the option to take a leadership role. It wasn't like a part of the deal terms or anything like that, but it was like, okay, like, is this something you're open to? And I said, look, I mean, maybe it's possible. And as, you know, I got closer and closer and what was going on at Angie, I did think to myself, like, yeah, this is a pretty interesting opportunity. Like, it was a big company. Like, by the time we left Angie, you know, it was this mess. It was doing, you know, over $10 billion of GMV, a billion plus of revenue, 7,000 people, hundreds of thousands of customers. It was a big operation. When I ultimately decided, okay, it's time to leave, it wasn't so much, there were certain parts that I really enjoyed. There were certain parts I didn't enjoy so much, but it wasn't like, oh, I just have to get away from this. It was more, I've been doing this a really long time. Mm-hmm. Like I'd been end to end, the thing was 12 years.
Wow.
And you don't get that many 12 year segments in your life. I recently turned 40. I turned 40 last November, so whatever, 2 months ago. And when I took a step back, I was saying, okay, like, I'm not so much running away from this or trying to get out. It was more, I just want to take another segment of my life and do something different with it. And I want to start or run or change or build or buy something else. And, you know, to your other question, like I considered all those options. Like I looked at all sorts of stuff. My co-founder from Handy, he left a couple of weeks after I left. So, you know, we had been working together for 12 years. So he left shortly after I left, and we would get together a couple of times a week. We'd riff on different businesses. We met hundreds of people, in all different categories.
What did you say to yourself, Oisin? Because I'm always curious as to the self-talk of founders. Like, what did you say to yourself when, like, you wake up on, like, the Monday morning and you're like, okay, this is new. What did you say? Because I'm really curious about that. Yeah, honestly, yeah, genuinely.
I'm a very list-driven person. I always have a list of stuff I'm going to do. So it wasn't like I woke up, I was like, oh, I wonder what I'm going to do. It was like, oh, well, like, I know this week I'm going to go to San Francisco. I'm going to meet these people. I had a list of fun things I wanted to do too. Like I went over to Japan. I went skiing for a week up in Niseko, which I had wanted to do for a long time. I went and visited friends that I hadn't, just hadn't found time to go see in a long time. I spent more time with my kids. So I had a list of business ideas and deals that I was exploring. I had some fun things that I wanted to do. And I had like some health stuff. I had some personal stuff I wanted to do. Like, I just had a list of things I wanted to do. And I was like, I'm just going to crank through the list and, you know, work the schedule and we'll see what pops out at the other end. And, you know, what came out the other end was, or sorry, well, the other things we looked at, like, we looked at there was a couple of businesses we tried to buy, and we put in deal terms and term sheets on them, and frankly, none of them came to fruition. There was a couple of later stage deal, like pre-public companies that I looked at again with a view of, okay, I would take on a CEO and a CEO role, and I'd also buy a part of the company as part of it. There was some public company stuff that I looked at where, you know, some folks were like, I was like, I really don't think I just want to go straight into running a public company, but I'll look at it. I looked at a couple of those and they all seemed to have like their own quirks and challenges. And again, it's not to say that I, you know, won't do it in the future, but the way I looked at these things was, I'll just see how long some of them stay alive. Like, you know, the ability for an idea to stay alive when you allow it to compete against other ideas is a good test of its endurance and resilience. You know, so this idea to start Keychain started, you know, before I left Angie. Like, this idea was alive in, you know, August or September of 22 was like when this like first was kicking around. By May, June of 23, this was probably only one of two or three things. Like, it had just, like, this thing just had resilience.
Right.
And, you know, it's a little unfair to say that when you, you know, the longer an idea stays alive, the more likely it is, because also you're putting a little bit of money into it. Like, we were spending on some Google ads, we were spending on some third party research at that point.
When you said spending on Google ads, what do you mean?
I mean, we tested out different, like, we threw up some landing pages. We had a contract to throw up some landing pages. We looked at what customer acquisition cost would look like. We tested out, like, what, how competitive it would be to buy keywords.
So you threw up mock-up kind of websites of what it is. Come on, it's the entrepreneur experiment, Oisin. You got to tell us about the experiments. This is what we're here for, man. Come on. You threw it out there like you hit the lead on me. Come on.
Yeah, I mean, we Yes, I think that is fair criticism and fair feedback. we did a lot of things. So, if that's important, like, let's unpack it.
Please, because I wanted to talk to you about new idea generation and selection, because I think that's where a lot of first-time founders and even second-time founders get caught in the mud. So I'd love to hear about how you actually did that. That'd be really interesting.
So we had a thesis similar to yours, which was it's hard for new brands to find manufacturers. And that was easy to prove. It's like, yeah, you talk to new brands. We've probably invested in 60 or 70 companies over the years. And some of them were brands or, you know, types of brands. And they always talked about this problem, how hard it is to buy manufacturers. But that doesn't really prove very much because, frankly, as great as new businesses are, manufacturers don't really want to talk to many of them because they aren't going to go anywhere. And there's just people with a little bit of an idea. And it's like, okay, well, it's not irrational that a multi-hundred-million-dollar manufacturer doesn't want to make your, you know, 10 sample soaps that you want to go and test out.
Yeah.
Like, that, you know, it's not a commercially lucrative problem. But we then went to the other extreme of the situation. And I don't know if you recall, but Handy and Angie partnered with some of the biggest retailers in the world. So Walmart's and Costco's, Target's, all those guys. So we got talking to them and we said, look, do you find it hard to find manufacturers? You make billions of dollars of private label product. Do you find it hard? Because if you find it hard, it might actually be a problem.
Yeah.
And they said, oh my goodness, it's so complicated. We are constantly in market. We have 3,000 products and we sell $9 billion a year. But, you know, we're supposed to have two suppliers for every product and we're not supposed to have more of our portfolio, like any more than a certain percentage of our portfolio with one manufacturer for supply chain risk and blah, 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 compliance and all this. I was like, oh my goodness, like, you're saying a lot of words that I'm going to have to go back later and find out what they are and what they mean, but it sounds like you're freaking out. And we then repeated that conversation with a couple of other larger brands and larger retailers. And we're like, okay, so it sounds like brands and retailers are struggling to find manufacturers. So we're at this point, you know, you abstract away what we're doing. We're validating one side of the problem. We then went to the other side of the problem, which are the manufacturers, the other side of the equation. And we said to them, look, do you find it hard? No, we started with, do you need more business?
Always a good starting point.
And they said, nope, we're full.
Really?
Like, okay, cool. I guess this puts this whole thing to bed. Fools that we are, we said, well, what, are you full everywhere? Are you full on all your lines? And they said, well, I don't know, who are you and what do you want? We're like, well, you know, we're thinking about doing this thing and, you know, we might have some credentials in the space. We built big marketplaces before. We're not total chancers. And they said, oh, well, I thought you were a customer. And I was like, well, I thought I was a customer. Why would you tell me you're full? And I'm like, well, that's, you know, that's just kind of the way the business works.
That's the dance. Make me want you. Okay. Wow.
And I said, well, are you full? And they said, no, like we've got, our main line might be full, but we have four other lines that are operating at 20, 40, and, you know, 30% capacity respectively. I was like, okay, so you do want more business? Like, yes, absolutely we do. I was like, okay. And would you pay for that business? And they said, well, how much are you going to charge me? What's it going to look like? And I said, I don't know. Like, how much is your average order? And they said, well, you know, the average customer does about $1.5 million a year across three orders. You know, they order three out of the four quarters. So the year, so $500,000 for the three quarters, each of the three quarters they do. And I said, oh, you know, do you mind me asking how much is your gross margin? They said, ah, yeah, it's kind of a little bit sensitive. I was like, well, I'm not going to do anything with it. And they gave us the number and it was like a quite high number. I was like, so if I get this right, on $1.5 million, you're going to make 30% gross margin. So you're going to take home $500,000 of you know, gross. And I said, like, would you give me 10% to that? And they're like, done. Wait a second. And he's like, for sure. It's like, okay, all right. So we went and repeated that exercise with, you know, 20 or 30 more manufacturers. But we were a little smarter the next time where we didn't start with, you know, do you have any business? Or sorry, do you, you know, will you make something for me? Because we learned that they trade on the opacity and the opaque nature of like them being busy. We started to put the pieces together from there. We're like, you know what, we've done at that point 50, 80, 100 manufacturer interviews and calls. And we use, some of it was network, some of it was, you know, through peer groups we're in, and some of it we used, you know, third party like GLG or wherever to actually make intros. Just again, this is down to the, you know, second founder, a second time founder that has a different position and has some capital to deploy. So it's like, okay, well, it's more worth it to me to have some more certainty on the market than it is to spend a little bit of money or save a little bit of money.
So did you invest money to go faster?
We did, yeah. We invested a little bit of money to validate the space and just get to more people faster. And at that point, you know, I had a number of investors who were pushing me, substantially pushing me to say, hey, look, if you're going to do anything else, I don't care what it is. Like, you made money for us last time, or we liked what you did last time, or whatever. I want to invest. And I'd been meeting with some of these folks on some cadence. And one day I was meeting with them. I said, look, I actually have an idea and I don't think it's total garbage. Why don't we talk about it? And we walked through it in very high level, arbitrary terms. And he said, I love it. Let's do it. And I said, well, why don't you go do some research and see, is it like, you know, what do your partners think, and go talk to some other people about it. And he then went and hired a bunch of experts and came back and said, I love it even more now that I've actually learned about it. Before, I just wanted to invest in you, but now this also doesn't seem like a terrible idea. Let's talk about a deal. And I said, well, can you help me at all talk to the people you talked to? I presume you found some industry people that were not idiots. Can I talk to them too? So, you know, we repeated that exercise with a couple of other investors, and every time we were basically getting to more and more industry people, and gaining more and more confidence that the thing had some merit, had some legs. You know, by the end, we, you know, had the investor thing the first time you raise money as a first-time founder, you're out there pitching this idea and trying to convince investors that it's not a bad idea and you should do it and that they should invest. Whereas I feel like, again, as a second-time founder, you have a little bit of a luxury, which is to say, I wasn't wedded to this idea. This wasn't like the thing that I have to go and do. So there was a little bit more of like, okay, I believe that I'm going to find an idea that I'm going to be passionate about and that I'm going to believe that we can do. This doesn't have to be it. So the conversation with investors was very exploratory and very like, okay, well, if this is it, like, let's convince ourselves like why it's it. And let's all look at the data. And let's look at let's look at every new piece of feedback we get. So, you know, we go and have a conversation and we get some new information, we take it back and we look at it from, you know, every side. Like, well, does this change our opinion? Does it change our thesis? And, you know, I do wonder whether first-time founders can do that too. Like maybe it is possible for first-time founders to do that. You just have to be, you know, more open that your idea may not be the one.
I wanted to ask you that because as you were talking to him, I'm like, I wonder, does this only apply to second-time founders? Because like so much of business is psychology, like 80% of business is psychology. And we kind of think, oh, this is the way it has to be done. Do you think first-time founders could be that transparent and that kind of like going, this is what I think? Or like there is a lot of social factors at play with you as well, like your track record, your pedigree, you know, and like it is a, you know, it's cliche, but it's cliche for a reason because it's pretty much true. They're backing you. They're backing the founder, right? They're backing your history. Do you think that's possible for a first-time founder to do?
Don't know. I really don't know. I think it's hard for a first-time founder. It's certainly harder for a first-time founder to do it. Is it impossible? I don't know. Depends on their pedigree, depends on what they did before, depends on their relationship with the investor. I mean, look, it's certainly true that if an investor believes you should do something more than they believe you should do it, which is kind of a bit of a thing to wrap your head around, then you have a position of leverage.
So right? From your initial research point of view, how long until you kind of went, this is going, we're doing it, triggers pulled?
A while. Like from the very first piece of research to when we pulled the trigger on saying like, yes, let's do it. Oh, easily 6, 7, 8 months.
Okay.
So yeah, a while. And then from there, we raised capital relatively quickly. We then, you know, I think the fog of raising capital can be a bit of a distraction, particularly first time capital or first money in. So we took a beat after that, after we raised the capital, and we said, okay, let's just like reassess. Let's make sure that everything that we originally said was still correct, that we learned anything new in this process of raising capital. Cause you talk to a lot of people when you're raising capital. And we built out a pretty robust, we had a main investor, but then we built out a pretty robust cap table of CPG strategics. You know, people in the industry, I think we must have taken 30, 40 checks from people in the industry, different people who are either executives at CPG firms or manufacturers or whatever. So
you, know, you just brought them in as investors?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So the cap table itself was like built out to help the business, but you know, the process of raising capital is just like, it's a bit of a, not a distraction. It's just a bit all encompassing that you don't really have the time to internalize all the information you're getting. So once we completed the cap raise, we then said, okay, let's just re-internalize all the information before we start deploying capital. Do we learn anything new? Does it change our thesis? Does it change our ideas? Does it change anything? And you know, on the margin it did, but it didn't change much, frankly, but it did give us more confidence in what we're doing. And then September of last year, we really started, wrapping up. So we started hiring some folks, doing some research, building some product. And then from there we have been bringing on partners. So we've been bringing on our manufacturing partners, bringing on retail partners. And the business, you know, what was originally, the first product was actually going to be the search and discovery part. And we were going to build the transactional part of the marketplace later, but we had such demand and so many people that wanted transactions earlier that we started organizing some transactions offline. So we, you know, signed some deals to actually broker you know, some of those transactions offline, even though we don't have the product yet. And then in the next few weeks, hopefully in sometime February, we will we'll get a product out the door. So yeah, we're getting close.
What would your, because you've given us kind of a masterclass there and kind of like new idea generation, selection, and then action. As like, let's say you're talking to first time founders now, and you're going, right, this is going to be your playbook for how you're going to get your product to market. You're going to select your idea, you're going to do your research, and then you're going to get your product to market. What would be your kind of 4-step, 5-step guide? You've kind of outlined it there, but if you're going to give us kind of 4 or 5 high level points, what would they be?
Don't do it. Get a job instead.
I'll flip it back to you. Were you ever tempted to do it completely differently? Were you ever tempted to kind of walk into the sunset, retire on those hundreds of millions and just go, I'm going to buy an island? Were you ever tempted to walk away?
Okay, so I think the way to answer your question, I'll do your four stepper rather than your like temptation to stop doing things. I think if I was to go do that, I would have to leave New York. I feel like New York is a very bad place to.
Are you just surrounded by energy?
You're just surrounded by a lot of people working, and anybody not working is just like getting into trouble, I think. So I think you're just like, you know, you're it's like, imagine being in Las Vegas and not having a job, but living there. I feel like you would just like not end up in a healthy place rather quickly. So I feel like if I was to, you know, ride into the sunset, to use your phrase, I would more literally need to leave New York and travel toward a sunset. I don't know, where is that? Is that Sunset Ireland, I guess?
No, I don't think it would be Ireland. Actually, I think we both know it's not. I think maybe southern Spain, Portugal, maybe.
But Ireland's beautiful for like some months of the year, isn't it?
for those 2 months, for July and August, boom. It's the best place in the world.
September, the kids go back to school. That's when you get the best weather. Everyone knows that. I mean, I was that kid in that classroom in Rathcoole, like looking out the window and, you know, the first week of September saying, how are we inside? It's only started being sunny now. So the four stepper, I think it's to identify the key things that have to turn out to be true.
Okay.
And most businesses have like a couple of things that have to be true. Talk to the people who, can determine whether or not those things will be true, or find a way to test whether they will be true. Look at the data that you have and the feedback you're getting with a third party who is not invested. So someone who is not emotionally, financially, whatever. So your partner, that's not the person to talk to, because they're just like so wrapped up in this thing with you and so whatever. Your friends, maybe, but like a true objective third party.
Like who?
Doesn't. Generally, like I find it to be helpful to talk to a peer. Mm. So somebody who I know who, you know, likes me, but, you know, runs a business of comparable size.
Yeah.
Has gone through a similar journey and can look at it and be like, listen, I know you want this to be true because you want this, but like this feedback is actually BS. And like these people are telling you not to do this. They're just not, you know, unkind enough to tell you that your idea is a pile of garbage. Mm. And so it's identify the things. Talk to the people or gather the data, review the data with a third party. And then the last one is give it time. So put time distance between you and the thing. And in an ideal world, like, I don't know, is it 4A, whether I have to add a fifth or whether I go 4A and 4B, during that time, allow it to compete with something else. So if the alternative is, you know, you're in a whatever 9-to-5 job working at, I don't know where I can say without offending somebody, but working at a job that you don't like, and your option is to keep working at this job or start business A, you're just going to look at all the data and everything you have to start business A as like, well, this is amazing. I should definitely do this. The grass is greener.
Yes. And every time
the boss is a jerk to you, or every time you don't get a pay rise, or your colleague gets promoted instead of you, or literally every, you know, the air conditioning is running too high and it's cold, or the traffic is shit, or whatever. Every time you're going to think, oh, well, business A is great. But if you're allowing business A during that time to compete with business B or business C or opportunity D, you know, maybe it's another job at another, you know, less bad place, give it time to actually compete rather than just marinate and like sell itself. It's even a healthier use of time. But time in general is better, but time where it's competing with something is even better.
I love that advice, because too often it's exactly what you said there. People are in a bad position and they just go, well, it can't be worse than this. And that's like the worst position to come from, like, because no matter what you're doing, but you won't find out for a long time. Yeah. You'll be broke and you'll find out.
Yeah. Sometimes you'll find out soon. Sometimes you'll find out slowly, but you know, there's like, oh, it can't be worse. You're like, no, it can be worse. Things can generally always be worse. You know, that is a poor turn of phrase. And in business, It is generally a very good idea to spend time considering the worst case scenario and whether you can emotionally take that financially. Can you take it career-wise? Like, can you get back onto a path? Like, it is definitely worth considering all those things. And the older you get in life, the more severe those consequences are. Like, there's a reason why, you know, it is not irrational for younger people to start businesses, because the opportunity costs are lower, the recovery period is like shorter, like all those things. They just work better, frankly. Failure is better earlier rather than later. No failure, better again, but like, you know, if you're going to have a possibility of failure, doing it earlier is better than later. And it's not to say like, you know, starting a business late is a bad idea. Like, there are many people that do it and it makes a lot of sense for them. But it is definitely worth considering the, and I don't mean on an ongoing basis, but a one-time exercise. Okay, let me just work through the financials. Like, what does happen if this all goes to SH1T? What happens if, you know, I blow this thing up and it publicly becomes a failure? Do I get another job? Do I need another job? What does that look like? Where do I go? Mm-hmm. What's my story? What's the narrative? Who's going to hire me? What's my backup plan? Et cetera.
I love that. Just before we go to our quick fire end, I know I'm conscious of time. I need to let you go in a second. I just want to ask you one more question. The flip side of things, you mentioned you did some investing over the last kind of couple of years. What are the kind of key things, because I like to kind of give people tangibles as they're listening, what are the kind of key things you look for as an investor in like a really good opportunity? So to flip it around on you.
I have a thesis on investing, which is very simple. It is not replicable or scalable. I invested in, it was myself and my co-founder. We do it together. We try and invest in three things. The three things are marketplaces, because we know and understand them and we can look at the metrics and look at the industry and be like, stupid, not stupid, or at least we think we can. Two, people we've worked with, or people we know, typically people we've worked with. Again, if we've worked with them, we know what they're like. We have watched them generally over many years, and we've invested in quite a few people we've worked with. And then the third is products where we were the business customer. So where Handy or Angie, you know, an early customer or one of the customers in the early set. And that is where we have predominantly deployed capital. We developed a fourth bucket, which we developed more to force ourselves to be honest than anything else. And the fourth bucket was things we like, but we shouldn't invest in. That really just allowed us to be more honest that everything that was in bucket one, two, and three was truly in bucket one, two, and three.
Have you any payouts yet, or is it all still in the market?
No, we've had some payouts. Nothing like billions and billions of dollars, but we get offers on stuff regularly enough. Like, one of the bigger ones we ran is Checker, which is a big background check company, which we regularly get offers for secondary on. But yeah, so some small stuff, but nothing that's you know, billions or tens of billions of dollars in terms of exit value.
Nice. So we're going to finish off with a quick fire round. This is new since you were here last, so strap yourself in. What's the one book you recommend every entrepreneur must read?
Hard Thing About Hard Things.
One of the most common books. It's either that or Shoe Dog. I'm going to have to crunch the numbers and see what's been the most recommended, but yeah, incredible book.
I'm not one for recommending sad books. I feel like the turn in that book really rips me apart.
Really?
I read books at night and I don't like the sad before the sleep. I find it.
Oh, well, I've an anti-recommendation for you then. I just finished the Barclay Brothers, the You May Never See Us Again book. Phenomenal book. Highly recommend you read it in the daytime. But like, it's like a horror at the end. The last three chapters were exactly what you said. I was reading it in bed. I was like, this is depressing. Like, what an empire they built, but I just built on sadness and bitterness and anger at the end. Great book to read though, but not before bed. What's something you had to learn the hard way? What's the one thing you had to learn the hard way?
No matter how many times you think that someone can change to do a role, if they don't want to change to do it, it's not going to work. And I feel like I've learned this a few times, or at least been burned by it a few times. I feel like some level of hopeless optimism captures me sometimes when I think about a person doing a role and I know they have the skill set and I know they have the technical capacity to do it and I know they have the drive to do it, but there's something about the way they operate that prevents them from having the right mentality to do it, because they don't see themselves as being that type of person or whatever it might be. And as a result, I see the best version of them being successful in this role rather than the real version of them.
You want it for them more than they want it for themselves. Really good answer. Thank you. What have you sacrificed to achieve your success?
The most valuable thing any of us have is time and health. There's only a certain amount of time that we're going to be healthy, and the alternatives of where I can spend that time is the biggest sacrifice. So, you know, you think about the fact that I look out the window and I don't see I don't see a Dublin skyline, I see a New York skyline. It's, you know, that pulls on me. It's the fact that I can't drive down the street at the end of the day and go see my dad and see other family members. And yeah, simply raw spending time in other places than at home with family.
What's something in your daily routine you wish had started sooner?
I get up really early and I thoroughly enjoy it. I think I've done it since I've had kids. I get up somewhere between 4:45 and 5 o'clock is when I typically get out of bed, get an hour and a half, sometimes 2 hours to myself to do what is the most deep, productive work that I can do. I used to be able to do this work at night. I don't know, is it just time or aging or like my biological rhythm or what? Like, I used to be able to sit down, like I remember years, decades ago at this point in college, I would knock out my most productive work between like 8:30, 9 and 11:30, 12 o'clock at night. I could write, you know, I'm at peak, I could write nearly 1,000 words an hour of like well-structured, thought-out work at that time. And, you know, a few years ago, I could barely write an email at the end of the day. And I wondered for a while whether I had like, you know, lost the ability to like just do that type of work, or like, could I just no longer pull it together, or was I too burned out or what? But it turned out it was just the wrong time of day for me now. And I can now get up in the morning. I can't crank 1,000 words an hour out, but I can get up in the morning and like immediately, no shower, nothing, just like get out of bed, go straight into my home office and go straight into a document and instantly focus on it and review, work, create, and, you know, from the ground up, or I can, you know, do work on a document. And that I find to be the best time of the day for me now to be able to just do that type of work. So I think, I guess the thing I've incorporated, and it's not just getting up early, it's identifying the time of day that is most suitable for work.
I think it's energy credits is the way I think about my day. So I get up in the morning, I have 10 energy credits in the bank. You know, I'm the exact same as yourself. It has flipped around. It used to be like, you know, up late, up early, whereas now it's like bed early, up early. And I find the exact same. My brain is different. And I think you go through seasons in life as well. I mean, you've got kids, you've other things focusing on your brain during the day. And plus, you know, that time is yours. By the evening, anything could have happened, but you know, if you're up that time is yours and your brain is obviously focused in. I think it's a great skill to be able to cultivate too, that ability to drop into like deep focus. I'm going to give you 1 million euro. You can invest it in one company or person. Who are you going to pick?
Oh my goodness. $1 million, and what am I going to do with it? Has anyone suggested they invest in you?
I don't think so, but I'll take it.
There you go. Yeah.
Okay, you're going to be owner of a media company. Brilliant. There you go.
No, I think you're going to do something else with it. I believe in you. I think you're going to do something else with it.
Thank you. That means a lot. Thank you very much. That's really nice. What big company is no one building? You've gone through hours of research. I'm going to get you to share all your Google Docs with me after this. You've gone through hundreds of ideas, all your research. What big market is no one building in that you think is an opportunity?
I don't know if it's a good business, but I see the content and I see the lowest common denominator of the lowest common denominator driver that a lot of childhood education focuses on, which is like attention grabbing and like captivating, flashing, like basically screen based, on what I would call unhealthy screen-based activities. I think that there's a big opportunity to tackle early education. And again, I'm obviously super exposed to it right now, so proxy school is the driver for me. But I think there's really a gap there in terms of building wholesome quality education that starts with the building blocks of teaching children how to learn. Like, I feel like, you know, we just teach kids stuff and content as opposed to starting with like, hey, how about we teach you how to learn to start with? And I think it can start quite early. So
I like that. I think that could go right the way through, to be honest. I think that could go to primary, secondary, third level. Teaching people how to learn is more important than just giving them facts and figures. And I think it's discussed for a different day, but I think AI, access to information, I think hopefully everything is going to change. It should be about how you learn. What do you believe that other people find strange or strongly disagree with?
I have a pretty strong view that our environment has a significant impact upon how we think about problems and how we address things. And I think that starts with the city. I think it starts with the setup, your room, your office, your like routine, your day. Like, I think that people's environment and routine, I don't want to say it determines outcomes because I think that's too strong, but I think it drives the probability of certain outcomes. And I think people underestimate how much those things increase or reduce the probability of them having the outcome that they want.
What's one thing in your life you spend money on that brings you immense happiness?
I have some hobbies that bring me happiness, and doing them with my kids brings me great happiness. I took my kids skiing, which is obviously an incredibly fortunate luxury experience. Watching my nearly 5-year-old ski down a 3.5-mile piece of mountain by herself was one of the highlights of probably one of the highlights of 2023, frankly. It was just great to like watch this little kid who, you know, a few days before couldn't put her skis on, and the rate and pace at which she could learn and, you know, get to a proficiency level where she felt confident enough to, you know, ski down this mountain where I would be a quarter mile away from her and she would feel like, yeah, it's totally fine. I can just see you at the distance and I can ski down by myself is amazing. And, you know, you could broaden it out to anything with anything where you're watching your kids or where I'm watching my kids develop and learn a new skill and get to a proficiency level where they just say something like, I'm so proud of myself. Like that's just amazing to watch. So that's a ton of fun.
That's gorgeous. What's your one final piece of advice to every entrepreneur listening?
My one final piece of advice, is take the time to figure out what you really believe in and what are the things that you're not going to compromise on, and write those things down. So to really write down what are the things you believe, whether it's to do with people, whether it's to do with, you know, your own set of values, whether it's to do with the trade-offs you're going to make, and really write those things down. And don't have to be maniacal, look at them every day, but to look at them with some level of cadence, whether it's every quarter or once a year. Because the reflection on what's important to you, I think, again, similar to your environment, your routines, actually drives outcomes.
I really strongly believe in that. When I've got a Notion doc called my principles document, and I look at it probably once a week, just high level what I believe in, because I think we live in such a noisy world and you're bombarded by so many bits of advice and new theories and new ideas, and you got to be doing this, and comparison really is the thief of joy. So I do look at it so often, and I think that is really, really, really good advice. Oisin, that was, as always, an immense chat. Thank you so much. Where can people learn a little bit more about Keychain and maybe contact you?
You can find me on Twitter, Oisin Hanrahan, or you can get me at o@keychain.com.
Perfect. And Keychain is keychain.com?
That's it.
Perfect. Oisin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure to talk to you. Take care.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you did, please hit subscribe on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts, as it really does help the podcast grow and reach new people. If you want to learn more about the podcast, go to mrgaryfox.com. I'll see you back here in a couple of days for a brand new episode.